up here tonight. It's been a while since I shared my story. And whenever I get asked to share my story, it always is a little bit of a reflection period. Like, what's going on? What do I have to say? And so when I first came in, I was taught that when you speak, you pray for God to give you the words. So I kind of try to get out of my own way and, you know, carry the message. And hopefully that's what will happen here tonight. I have been sober since February 24th, 1998. So I got sober when I was 38 years old. I had spent 26 years drinking. And this February, I will celebrate 26 years of sobriety. So I'm going to be half and half coming up pretty soon. So somewhere along here, hopefully I've grown up a little bit. I came from a family of alcoholics. They were pretty prominent. My dad was a lawyer. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. We went to church and where there was a very punishing, vengeful God with fire and brimstone. And, you know, so I tried to be a good girl and do all the bright things. And at home, they were both alcoholics. And there was a lot of domestic violence. This was back in the 60s, so there was not a lot of recourse or help for women in that position at that time. And I can remember, like, laying awake at night and then waiting to hear the fight, and then to go downstairs and get in between them to try to stop the fighting. And I was about 5. And usually this strategy would work, but sometimes it did not. And it would literally be pulled apart by the two of them and their fighting. And like a good alcoholic child, you never talk about what's actually going on. And my family is crazy. And that's a big part of my story, is like how important it is that I come in here and be with you to help me, because they're still my family. You know, I can walk away from them, but sometimes you can't. And I can remember one time my dad was a philanderer. He was also an abuser. And he was out late. But he would go to church every Sunday and teach Bible study. So my mom was in the bathroom. I'm like, Mom, what are you doing? What are you doing? And she wouldn't answer me. And finally, I figured out how to pick the lock and got in there. And she had found my dad's porn, and she was cutting it up and putting it in his Bible so that the next day, when he went to teach Bible study, he would open it up and there it would be. And I'm like, oh my gosh, do I tell him? What do I do? I'm gonna be there. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want this to happen. And the insanity, that's like the perfect story of the insanity of my family. And I mean, this went on, I mean, we left when I was 9. So all this was prior to that. And, you know, but along that way, I got that feeling that I had to be in control, that I had to be in charge. I had to look out for my little sister. I had to make sure my mom was safe and all of that. And then, you know, obviously it didn't work and my mom finally did leave. And I was so grateful that she did leave, because the fear of the violence was just so pervasive. When we did leave, we went from living in a great big nice house to kind of living down at Ocean View, and I saw my first roaches and all the things, but I was a lot happier. And I really learned not to value material things that much. So I think that was good. And I also learned, like, that you got to do the right thing, no matter how hard it is. Because my mom did that, and it was not easy at that time. So, you know, things move on, and I was a young teen, and I was in a pretty bad situation in the schooling back then, and I was assaulted in the school. So, like, I got beat up pretty bad. And at that time, like, I was like, my mom's like, I was kind of probably having a nervous breakdown. I was 12 or 13 years old. And instead of her going, you know, maybe we should get you a little help, she's like, here, some Valium. Try these and go to school. So I'm like, okay. So, and I was like, oh, ease and comfort. Jumping on in there. And I'd already started smoking weed at that point. And I just remember going, you know, if I can, I am going to get high at all times. And that became my goal. So of course, when you're that young, it's hard to get alcohol. The first time, and my dad used to like, make me a drink. Here, you wanna try the scotch? I was blowing smoke rings at the age of 3. I mean, crazy family. So anyway, the first time I got drunk, I had my little boyfriend in the 7th grade, and we both took a little bit of each bottle from our parents and then went down to the beach. We were living down at Lynn Haven Inlet at the time, and he goes, look, and we called it Witcher Brew. We had these big jars of pure alcohol, and he's like, look, and I'm like, ha, watch this, and I just chugged the whole thing. Next thing you know, it's the next day, I had thrown up, blacked out, passed out. He had to drag me in from the sand dunes. My mom blamed everything on him. And my first thought was, oh geez, next time I'm just not gonna drink so much. Not that, no, I'm never gonna do that again, but that I would just try to get a better handle on it. And that was basically it. Like, I was gonna get high. I got a boyfriend way too old for me. I was very good in school, so that's helpful. If you're good in school, like, you know, because I like to read, and I was also really good at art, so those were my two big things. Like, so if you're good in school, you can get away with a lot. So it skipped school a lot, you know, it's hanging around with, you know, all the partiers, the stoners, we called it back then, and you know, I didn't really like it that much in school, but the first time I got arrested, I was only 16 years old. I was with my older boyfriend, got pulled over by the cops. I'd been in a bar, believe it or not, and got thrown in jail for possession of marijuana. And I can remember sitting in the jail cell with no shoelaces, no belt, going, you know what, I'm not gonna do this anymore. This is not a good place. And of course, my dad was a big lawyer, and he said, they called my mom to come get me, and she's like, no, call her father. I was like, oh my God. And so they just kind of left me in there. And that sadly, I got out that next day and skipped school and did it all again. Like, you know, the thought that I'm not gonna do this anymore occurred to me at 16. But as you see, I went on for another 22 years of not doing that, of not stopping, of not even thinking of stopping. So, you know, I just continued on in that vein. I graduated from high school early. I went to college, and somehow I drank my way through that experience. But I have a degree in fine art, which is a studio art degree. But of course, I was not really capable of pursuing that because it was a mess. And was married a guy that was also an alcoholic. And so guess what? There was a lot of domestic violence. There was a lot of badness that came along with that. But I had a little boy, and he was just amazing. He was like the coolest kid ever. He's just, you know, like a little old soul, you know what I mean? When he got a little bit older, he'd be like, don't act like grandma now. And I'm like, oh, you're right. You know what I mean? If I would ever try to guilt and shame him or anything, he was just like always on point with, you know, helping me realize what was right. And it didn't take me too long to realize I should get out of this marriage. And it was bad. I mean, he was 10 years older than me. And so his disease was way more progressed. Like, you are the problem, not me. You know, your drinking is the problem. And he was a lot, like, he's one of the worst alcoholics I've ever met in terms of how much he could drink. And I think for women, a lot of us can, you know, stop drinking, we're pregnant, you know, we can kind of put the brakes on things to help us to, you know, be there for our kids when they're little, but, you know, it's just in our mind always that this is gonna kick back in as soon as I get a chance. Or as soon as I can go to our party, or as soon as I can do this, or as soon as I can do that. And of course, I did do a lot of drugs along the way there. This was back in the 70s, I mean, and 80s. So there's, you know, all that thrown into the mix. Whatever I could get, I would do. I didn't do like needles or anything like that, mostly just because I'm squeamish. But I probably would have if I wasn't afraid of them. So that bad marriage ended, and then I got in another bad marriage. and I have my daughter, and she is amazing. She is a like little light beam, and I was really blessed to have like two amazing children, and they should have been enough for me to go, I should stop drinking. But what happened is they would go to dad's on weekends. And I was back in the restaurant business. I was tending bar. I was having a blast. I got rid of both of those controlling husbands. And their kids would be gone on the weekend. And I would just be, all up and down Shore Drive. There's bars. And that's where I worked. And that's where I drank. And that's where I get DUIs. And, you know, it was just all, it was every weekend. It was on a roll. And I had gotten a couple of arrests, you know, for drinking in public, and I'd gotten a DUI. And then along this way, I'm in my second offense DUI, and I'm a single mom with two kids. And I'm looking, and they're like, oh, you'll get off. You know, the laws weren't so bad back then. So I paid all this money to get a good lawyer so I could get off. And when I went to court, the judge was like, my BAC was 2.3. And I wasn't even that drunk. Like the cop was like, you know what? I said, that thing is wrong. I'm not that drunk. And he says, you're right. So he tested me again. And he goes, you must be an alcoholic, because nobody with a BAC that high should be able to be walking and talking like you are. I mean, the only reason he pulled me over is because I was speeding or I had no lights on or something ridiculous like that. And I was like, really? You know, I mean, I think the machine is broken. Of course the machine is broken. I can't really have a BAC that high. So the judge took exception to that high BAC and did not care that I was a single mom with two kids and threw me in jail right then and there. So I had to call my mean ex-husband and say, hey, you got to go get our daughter. I kissed her goodbye and said, mommy, you'll be right back. And I was in jail. And I was like, he's like, well, you need to get out of there. Come get our daughter. I'm like, you know I'm locked in, right? They're not going to let me out because you said so. And so while I'm in jail, which, by the way, I did not like, I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to drink anymore. This is it. You know, these kids deserve to have a good mom, and I'm not a good mom when I'm drinking and I'm hungover and all the things like that. And both their dads were not what I would want them to be in custody of these kids. So if it wasn't for my kids and that desire to be the mother that they deserve to have, I probably would have just gone back. But do you know how long I stayed sober when I got out of jail? One day. That's it. But then was the horror. Then was the desire to quit drinking for the first time in my life. And I could not. I just kept getting smaller and smaller and smaller into this little box. I couldn't drive for 3 years. If I got caught again, I would be a habitual offender. I would go to jail for 1 year and my kids would have no mom. They would be with their dads. Yet I could not stop drinking. And so I was ordered a court ordered treatment, and right away they're like, we gotta put you in this family group because your family is so messed up. Prior to this, my father had died of alcoholism at the age of 56. So I was only like 20 some when he died. And my mom was still kicking. In fact, she's still kicking at the age of 93. But so there was a lot of consequences of the drinking in my family, my father dying young, helping him, you know, taking care of him as he was dying and watching that. You'd think that would make you not want to drink, but it doesn't. Nothing seems to make us want to not drink. But then, and many of you may have experienced when you really do want and you can't stop. And one day it was court order treatment and the lady was like, I had drank the night before, and I was always trying to like count my drinks, make sure that I came in and wouldn't blow in the thing, and then, but you know, all the mechanizations that it talks about in the book, I would do. And I'm like, yeah, man, I'm going through a divorce. I just got out of jail. And my husband came and told me that he had gotten this teenage girl pregnant and he was going to be a father at any minute and blah, blah, blah. And she's like, and you're staying sober through this? And I just busted out crying. And it was the first time that I could admit that I couldn't stay sober. And she could have violated me. She could have sent me back to jail. But she gave me a hug. And she said, you are a sick person who needs to get well. Not a bad person that needs to get good. And that was like the chink that I needed. Like, that woman saved my life in that moment. You know, we have these God moments. That was a huge God moment for me. And it still took me a while before I came, you know, I got drunk again in the night when nobody was looking. And then I was so hungover, I couldn't get up. I'm like, that's it. I'm going to AA. So I got up. By the time I finally could get up, it was 6 o'clock, and I went to an AA meeting. And it was a big meeting out there in Virginia Beach. And I was like, oh my gosh, oh, what am I supposed to do? I said, hey, what am I supposed to do? I've never been to a meeting before. And the lady's like, raise your hand, say you're a newcomer. I did what she said. I said, okay, now what do I do? She goes, when we get to the end, you go up there and get a white chip. And when I raised my hand to say I was an alcoholic, I could barely say it. You know, it was like, I'm a Jennifer. You know, it was so hard to do. But it was so important to do that. You know what I mean? It's step one. Step one began that moment. And then when I got up there to get my white chip, because she goes, go up there and get a white chip. Everybody was like, whoa. And it was a whole lot of people in there. Everyone was like, whoa. I'm like, man, these people are crazy, man. I'm up here, the worst moment of my life, and they're cheering like it's some kind of victory. But it made me go, wow. These people are doing something. I don't know what it is. And that was the one and only white chip I ever picked up. And I really didn't think that this stuff would work because I just didn't. I was like, you know, we all think we're so special and so different. And I was like, this will never work. But they're like, you know what you need to do? You need to stick with the women. I'm like, stick with the women? Why would I want to do that? You know, because of course I'm already looking for boy meets girl on AA campus. But I did that, and I started going to women's meetings, and I got a sponsor, and I started doing the things that she said. And it was really amazing how, you know, quickly I became a part of. At that time, everybody was smoking. I was cleaning ashtrays. I was so happy. I was cleaning the toilet. I was so happy that I, you know, whatever I can do, because it was like an AA clubhouse, and it was there all the time, and you could go to meetings day and night all the time. And I really needed to do that for a long time, especially on holidays, because my family is all still drinking. And it was like some night, and the bars on Shore Drive were still there, and my buddies, and sometimes I'd be driving and be like, I wonder if so-and-so's in the bar tonight. I could just stop on in and say hello. I don't have to have a drink. But that's how your disease is tricking you, right? Because if I wanted to see the person, I could give them a call, right? I didn't have to stop in any bar, and it was just looking for an excuse. So when my mind would be going that way, I would find somebody like go out there and talk until the bars were shut at 2 o'clock at night, you know, so I wouldn't have that temptation. And that's how I was, you know, trying to do it. I found out that this old timer told me, if you have AA meetings in your house, it'll bring a lot of love in there. So I went, they had an AA meeting, well, it was a study group, like to study a book, and I went to it, and it was the first one I'd ever been to at anyone's house, and the girl was like, well, this is the last time we can do it, we're moving. You know, they were in the Navy or something like that. Can anybody do it? And I'm like, I can do it. So I ended up having a study group at my house every Sunday for the next, I think, 5 years. And it was amazing because we would study spiritual literature, mostly AA starting out, but then we'd branch out in different things and we would go to see plays and we would do things together. And I learned to really have a good time. And I really learned to build a foundation. I would say that I had faith when I walked in the doors, but I didn't have a kind and loving God, and they told me I could have a kind and loving God. And I said, well, I want one of those. You know, but it's still hard to overcome. You know, like if you're brought up with a lot of guilt and shame, it's hard to overcome that. When I was about, I wasn't quite 2 years sober, I was doing a four-step, and I was not doing well. I was writing all this stuff down, and I couldn't wait to tell my sponsor. And all these things, and I started having nightmares. And I started having these, what I came to know as flashbacks in my mind. I thought I was going to die. I almost ran my car off the road, leaving a meeting one night, and I told my sponsor, I said, there's something wrong with me. I think I'm going to die. And she said, you're having panic attacks. And she was kind of a bitch. And so she was like, you're gonna hang up the phone and you're gonna call the mental health service right now and you're gonna come back to me, they said. So I did that mostly because I was afraid of her, and I had never really gotten any help for mental health. You know what I mean? And clearly I was having a crisis. And so when I called them up, I said, look, I'm in recovery and I'm not doing well. I almost killed myself last night and I'm afraid I'm gonna drink. And they're like, we'll see you right away. Come in right away. And I was like, wow, someone's gonna help me. You know, I mean, all this crazy life I had lived, you know, I always try to keep it all covered up so no one would know. I didn't want anyone to know, because trust me, I can look so normal and so happy all the time. And I'm very, very good at it. Most of us are, you know, like chameleons. I people please, do all the things. And so I started on the journey of really getting outside help. And I tell people this part of my story because it's really a difficult thing to talk about, but I see it all the time. This is the roadblock you might hit. And if you don't get help, you'll drink again. And it actually, for me, ended up being repressed memories of childhood sexual abuse. It was really, really bad. And I know so many people in the program that have had the same thing happen. And my very own sister was ordered into treatment, and of course, we never talk about it. And she's a bad alcoholic as well. And it's just two of us. And she ended up with the same therapist. And the therapist is like, get your sister, see if she will sign this release so I can talk to you about what we talked about. And we did really intensive therapy to help me not drink. And so I signed it for my sister, and she, you know what she did? She drank again. And that was it for her. I mean, she's doesn't drink at this moment, but she is not in recovery in any way, shape, or form. She's batshit crazy. So I know that it's important that, you know, if you need outside help, get outside help. It's just what you need to do. You know, depending, you know. So all this is going along just fine, and So I would say my son was 14, my daughter was 5 when I got sober. So you can guess what's going to happen. The 14-year-old decides he wants to smoke weed. Of course, his dad's an alcoholic. His mom's an alcoholic. He's smoking weed. He's getting trouble in school. He's doing all the things. And so, of course, I'm, you know, Miss Al-Anon mom, you know, being really harsh on, you know, I'll take your car, man. I'll do whatever. I'd do whatever I could to help him not go down that road. But, and many of you probably have the same experience with your kids. You know, like, why would you do this? You see what can happen. But, you know, it's their path, not our path. And I can remember VisiPa was just coming out at the time, and I would see all the people at VisiPa. I'm like, hey, man, get that VisiPa going, because, you know, my son's going to be there soon. And he picked up his first keychain, I think, when he was 15 years old. And, you know, and of course my daughter was little, and she doesn't really remember anything about my drinking. And she grew up in AA rooms and women's meetings and going to the alcathons and running around and doing all the things like that. So she had a different mom than my son had, you know, because they're 9 years apart. And so I would say everything was going along pretty good. About this time, I decided this is kind of a cool step five, four and five thing. I had never used my art degree. And my daughter was identified gifted in art when she was little. And I went to the special school she went to. I'm like, this is so cool. I really want to do this. I want to teach. So I went back to school and got certified to teach art. And I started, I wanted to work in an inner city school. And I wanted to work in a high school. And so I went out there and I got a job at inner city high school, and I was so happy. However, when you are going to be a teacher, you have to check these boxes. Have you ever been arrested for drugs? Have you ever been arrested for a crime against a child? And they lump those two things together, at least they did at the time. And so I already had the job. I was just waiting for my licensure in the mail. When I get the thing, you have to go in front of the Board of Education because they wanted to know what was my crime. And it was so, it made me so mad because I was like, man, that was back when I was 19, man. Here I am, I'm all, you know, blah, blah, blah. They shouldn't be doing this, they shouldn't be doing that. And, you know, the truth is, like, I committed so many crimes I never got caught for. You know what I mean? I drove drunk so many times. I could have killed people. I could have done so many things, you know. I mean, I used to sell drugs. I mean, I never got caught for any of that. So to sit there and begrudge that one charge they did catch me for was really my own hubris, right? And so it was at this time of year, and I had to speak. And I'm like, what am I going to say? I did all this work, and now I'm going to get kicked out of my job. I'm not going to get my license. I don't know what's going to happen. All because I told the truth. But guess what? We know we cannot live with lies anymore. We have to be honest. We have to be four and five, right? We have to tell the truth. Somebody wants to know it, we have to tell it. And I didn't want that hanging over. I mean, I could have lied, but I was like, well, if you don't get it, so be it. That's not what you're supposed to do. And that's had to be my attitude and what I got up and shared in the group, because if I didn't get the licensure, that just meant I was supposed to do something else. And that is, to me, faith. Faith is not, I want this, and I better get it. Faith is, whatever comes before me, as long as I don't drink and I try to do the next right thing, everything's going to work out for the best. Maybe not to me, maybe not seems like that to me, but that is my choice. It ended up, I did get my licensure, and I became a teacher. So it all worked out, so I guess, you know, I guess higher power had that in store for me. And I had only been teaching for 1 year, and I got that phone call that is every person's worst nightmare. My son was coming home from a party, and he wrecked his car and died at 21 years old. And it was so hard, and it's still so hard, because I really believed that he would get sober. I really believed that he could come over the addiction that he was pretty much born to have. And he was handsome and charming, and he was coming into his own, you know what I mean, like as a man. And then it was gone, just like that. And it was so difficult, and it was too big to talk about. And everyone in AA showed up because they'd been in my house. They knew my son. They knew my daughter. She was like 12 years old. She adored her brother. And he was everybody's favorite. You know, you always hear that about people who die. But in this case, he was everybody's favorite in the whole white family. And his dad had finally got sober. He had 6 months clean. And he showed up for me that night. And the two of us went through the hardest thing that any two people could go through together. And people who know us, and a lot of people do know us, are like, you two are a miracle. Because this was a bad marriage. And now he's one of my best friends. Both sober. And he almost died many, many times. He's only got like 5% liver. And he and I walked through that together with the help of people in AA. And I recently joined this committee, and I saw somebody I hadn't seen in years. And they were like, you know, you saved my life. I had this happen to me quite a bit. They're like, we watch you not drink when you went through that. I mean, there's people on Facebook that write me. I moved to California, but every year on my anniversary, I was 90 days sober when I watched you walk through that without picking up a drink. And the truth of the matter is that love is a powerful, powerful thing. And I would never want to take away one moment of my love for him by drowning it out in a drink. And if I did that, that would be such a dishonor to him. And so I just didn't even consider it for not one second, because he would never have to worry about this disease. And it is a family disease, and it is a destroyer of families. But because of AA, we can have a different outcome. Maybe we won't, but maybe we will. Maybe we will. So that was really, really hard. I attribute a lot of it to the fact that I had that study group and I had worked on my faith. But at that point, I was like, you know what? I'm not talking to you anymore because you took away my son. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, that's it. You know, I'll do all these things. And you know, I've suffered a lot of depression throughout the whole time. And luckily for me that I had a career I just started, and I could throw myself into that, and I was doing really, really well. And I had done service work in AA, and I found out, guess what, I'm a pretty good leader. So I became a leader in my field, and I started working with the Art Education Association, and I became the president of the local thing of that. And my boss was like, I think you'd be really good at you know, doing presentations. So I was like, okay, I'll try. You know, we learn at AA. People tell you do something, you do it. I knew I could speak because I've been speaking in AA, because I was 7 years sober when all that happened. So I started doing presentations, you know, and I would go to, started out locally, then did the state level, then I went up to the national level, and everything was really going really good. And then I quit my job because there was a lot of violence in the school where I was, and I was like this, and the doctor's like, you know what, you need to quit your job. There's no medication I can give you to make you feel safe when you're not. And I thought I would get another job right away, but I didn't. I was like, okay then, what am I supposed to do now? So I was trying this and trying that, trying this and trying that. I work at area museums as a teacher, and one day at the museum, they dropped off these scholarship kids. And I told the lady, I said, oh, I see the scholarship kids here. You guys need any help in your organization? And the lady was like, yes, we do. Would you like to volunteer? So I started volunteering as an art teacher for this organization. Well, eventually, they needed an art teacher, and I got hired for that. Eventually, I became the program director of the whole thing. And then the pandemic, well, before that happened, I had bought a condo and I was doing really well in my job, and then I quit my job and get another job. You know, I was working, doing this and that. And it was so weird because the principal and I were not, like, she had some unethical practices that I would not do. So I was always in trouble, you know. Some of us AAs are little cage rattlers, you know what I mean? Like, we're not going to do this wrong thing. I don't care what you say, because I'm not going to drink, you know what I mean? So I'm not going to do that thing. And anyway, so I said, well, what can I do? Maybe I can go rent this condo and go stay with my aunt. My aunt lived all by herself. She didn't have any kids or whatever. So I moved in with my aunt, and I was like, you know what, God, I've been praying for a partner, but this is not what I had in mind. Because it didn't take me long to realize that I kind of got myself in a situation that she kind of needed someone there. She was getting elderly. I'm still there today, and it's very, very, very hard to deal with. You know, this is not my house. I never not had my house. It's her house, and it's always her house. And that's it. And she's pretty selfish and self-centered. Very religious. But the interesting thing is I learned a lot about my faith from her, because she lives with a lot more fear than I do. Because I have you guys. I'm always telling her, who's in charge? She's like, I am. I'm like, no. No, you're not. Your higher power is in charge. You go to church, you have faith. You know that things are going to work out. Right. So I haven't loved it. But when the pandemic came, it was really hard for me because I'm kind of an extrovert. I like people, blah, blah, blah. And I was but I still, the place that I was working for was a nonprofit that worked with kids from Park Place, which is a poor neighborhood in Norfolk. And they were going to close, and they offered their assets to other nonprofits. So then one of them picked it up, and I could apply for the art position there. Now this is where it's really amazing, because I was, you know, I would say that step 12 is my life today. Like, I help my elderly mom constantly. I help my elderly aunt constantly. I have a job where I work with people that, families that are homeless and in extreme poverty. I got trained at work. They're like, okay, we're gonna train you with mindfulness. Well, when I was going through that whole big thing of being so depressed and down, and I really turned to step 11 and saw through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God, which who I'm not talking to, by the way. So, but I'm still, you know, it was so funny because the guy, there was a 11-step meeting at the beach, and the guy would lead a guided meditation every morning, every Saturday morning. And then he was gonna be gone one day, and they're like, can anybody do this for me? And it was like, I could feel the nudge. Okay, I'll do it. And everybody was joking me so hard. They're like, because I'm like real hyper, as you probably noticed. I'm real hyper, I'm ADHD, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, and my friend Paul, he was like, man, I heard this girl named Jennifer is leading the meditation, and I know it's not you. And I'm like, actually, it is me. He's like, no way, there's no way, you can't hold still for 2 seconds. And he came there to see if I could actually lead the guided meditation. And he said, I had to keep opening my eye because it didn't even sound like you. And the truth is, it really isn't me, because I get out of the way. You know what I mean? And that's something as an artist that you can do too. You get out of the way and allow that creativity to come through you. Just like I'm trying to do right now. Like, this isn't about me. Hopefully somebody's going to hear something tonight that's going to make them, you know, remember to have some gratitude or remember what step they need to take a look at. So the 11th step has been a huge part of things for me. So then back to the 12th step in my job. So I work with these families and they trained us on mindfulness. Well, guess what? For this mindfulness, I learned the neuroscience about why what we do works. And I get to teach it to kids through art. And it is the coolest thing ever. Because I'm like, this is like the perfect job for me. Because it's what I already do. It's what I already know. And I developed this series of lessons. And I just got to go to San Antonio, present it at the national level. They're now using this technique. I got a letter from a lady in Hawaii. They had just had all the fires and everything. She goes, I just got funding to do this lesson. We're doing it with the kids across the board. So it's like, wow, that is so cool. I mean, how does that even happen? How does that even happen? That this message, right? Because it's no different than this message, right? I mean, these are kids from trauma. They're, you know, everybody in this room, I guarantee you, has trauma. If you're an alcoholic, you have trauma. Even if nobody gave you trauma, you gave it to your own self, you know? And that's what this, these are some of the things that I've helped the kids do. But it's really a hard job because, I mean, I see things and kids tell me. And everybody's like, how do the kids tell you? I'm the art teacher. That's where the feelings are. So I'm always, you know, having to call CPS or do this or that. You know what I mean? And you don't know what's going to happen. You know it's not good, no matter what. You know it's not going to be good. But, you know, I had the coolest thing happen is this one family is really going through it. The mom is a drug addict. The dad was in jail. The kids were, they were all homeless. They got housed. But now the mom is dying from the results of her drug addiction. And those kids love to draw. They love to draw. And they're really, really good at it. And they don't talk much. But they'd come up and just hug my knees, you know? And they sent me a present. They made these little earrings. And they thanked me. They don't have anything. But they thanked me for being there for them and helping them. And to me, that was the greatest Christmas gift that I could have gotten from these people who don't have anything that they were could see in their life, that there's people that are looking out for them and looking out for their kids. And I have to remember to be grateful. And my family is very, very sick, very, very dysfunctional. My sister's husband, they broke up. He was domestic violence. He's currently in prison for killing his girlfriend. My two nephews do not drink, but they are untreated alcoholics. We just found out that the one that stays in the room all the time and doesn't do anything, come out, just got arrested by the FBI. I'll let you figure out what he did. And it's like nobody sees help. Just me. But here's the best part about the whole story. My daughter is a little light being. She is so amazing and so beautiful. And she's a kind and loving person. And she's not an alcoholic. She can drink a half a drink and just leave it sit there. I've never seen anything like it in my life. So weird. But you know, and I would say that my life has not turned out, you know, the way I would have hoped. But you know what? The cycle is broken in her. She's got a partner now. She's moving up the corporate ladder on her job. And she is just a good person. And she is happy. And if that's the only thing I have right now, I think that's pretty daggone amazing. Anyway, thanks for letting me share.